Welcome to All Things Collected, brought to you by the Journal of Antiques and Collectibles, a special interest magazine for dealers, collectors, and enthusiasts of antique collectibles. I'm your host, Erica Lohm. Today's episode is dedicated to the writing desk, that special and deeply personal space where so much history and inspiration takes place. Think any flat surface will do? Well, then pull up a chair and learn more about the history of the desk and the writing desks and habits of famous authors. But before we get started, let's catch up on what's happening in the world of arts, antiques, and collectibles. Israeli archaeologists have found a rare ancient toilet in Jerusalem dating back more than 2,700 years when private bathrooms were luxury in the Holy City. The Israeli Antiquities Authority said that the smooth, carved limestone toilet was found in a rectangular cabin that was part of a sprawling mansion overlooking what is now the Old City. It was designed for comfortable sitting, with a deep septic tank dug underneath. Quote, "A private toilet cubicle was very rare in antiquity, and only a few were found to date," said Yaakov Billig, the director of the excavation. "Only the rich could afford toilets," he said, adding that a famed rabbi once suggested that to be wealthy is, quote, "to have a toilet next to his table," end quote. Animal bones and pottery found in the septic tank could shed light on the lifestyle and diet of people living at that time, as well as ancient diseases. If you really want to understand ancient Egyptians and their afterlife practices, here's a new spot to add to your bucket list. Just over a mile from the iconic Pyramid of Giza sits the Grand Egyptian Museum, a still under construction attraction that will soon house more than 50,000 ancient Egyptian artifacts, according to Smithsonian Magazine. Of those 50,000 objects, from a to-scale replica of King Amenhotep III to masks from older royal tombs, 5,000 will be from King Tutankhamun's tomb alone. Some 30,000 of the artifacts to be on display at the new museum have never been seen by the public before, including many of King Tut's garments, which are incredibly fragile and risky to display. The tomb, which was first discovered in 1922, will be nearly recreated in this space, giving visitors a first-hand look into the life and death of the Golden King. The tomb was originally unearthed in 1922, and another exciting discovery came in 2016, when a new high-tech radar scan indicated that there were two additional chambers beyond King Tut's, including one that may have belonged to Queen Nefertiti. As of now, the museum is expected to open in November 2022 after extensive political and financial delays. Charleston is well known for its temperate winters, but sitting fireside would not always have been enough to keep residents toasty throughout its history. Although the city has witnessed flurries many times over the years, the winter storms of 1899, 1873, 1989, and most recently 2018 left the city blanketed in snow. Fur and Frost, Carolina Winters, the Charleston Museum's latest installation in its historic textiles gallery, opened October 2, 2021. This exhibit showcases historic fashions for winter, from 1890s children's coats to 1920s fur stoles and 1950s acrylic sweaters. While immersed in this exhibit, you will learn why wool and fur dominated the 19th century fashion industry and how the rise of new synthetic materials, frequently designed for cooler temperatures, has actually contributed to the climate change in the 21st century. Tucked away in the stacks and study rooms of the New York Public Library, you'll find much more than books. From a lock of Edgar Allan Poe's hair and Charles Dickens' cat paw letter opener, to a collection of personal papers from Dr. Maya Angelou, the library system is full of fascinating items. In celebration of the brand new Polanski exhibition of New York Public Library's treasures, the first permanent exhibition to showcase highlights from the library's collections of more than 46 million items, Atlas Obscura and the library have created a bi-monthly series of online experiences where they'll uncover rare literary artifacts and ephemera from the library's hidden corners that most people never get to see. Streaming live from some of NYPL's most incredible locations, you'll go behind the scenes to explore obscure personal artifacts of famous authors, rarely seen maps, forgotten menus, and so much more. In this experience, you'll also get a sneak peek at the brand new exhibition that features 250 of the rarest and unique items from the library's extensive research collections. Among the items on display are Thomas Jefferson's handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence, the stuffed animals that belonged to the real-life Christopher Robin and inspired the Winnie the Pooh stories, and a page of Malcolm X's unpublished autobiography chapter, The Negro, as well as his briefcase. You'll be among the first to see them on the display. For more Marketplace news, sign up at journalofantiques.com to receive our free post-press update delivered twice a month to your inbox. And we're back with our publisher, Maxine Carlome, and a brief history of the desk.
If you're one of those people who feel any surface will do, then it might be hard to understand the writing desk culture and the personal connection many people have about the space and surface on which they work. The word desk comes from the 14th century Latin desca, meaning a table to write on. But over the last few centuries, a desk has evolved to become so much more in the lives of its users. The earliest form of the antique desk was a bureau, a hinged, sloping front desk within which the writing surface can be opened and closed. There were an adaptation of a box or board onto which the writing slope was fitted. At first, the sloping surface sat on a stand or pillar legs, but soon there was a need for a purpose-made writing desk. By the 1960s, the writing slope merged with the chest of drawers. Antique bureaus are essentially a fusion of those different types of furniture, a writing desk and a chest of drawers. They were very fashionable during the Queen Anne period, 1702 to 1714. The Queen Anne period bureau was followed by the knee-hole writing desk. This was a small desk with drawers on either side of a knee-hole, which was often fitted with a central cupboard. These were either veneered in walnut or provincially constructed of oak. It is not until the 1750s that we start to see the pedestal and partner's desks that have become so popular today. By 1800, the Gothic and French-inspired Chippendale style gave way to the more regal federal style of furnishing, which remained popular through 1820. From 1820 to 1840, Empire-style design, which featured oversized furnishings adorned with elaborate carvings, had gained popularity. Furniture makers were commissioned by their wealthy patrons to craft writing tables for the home as a show of their wealth, importance, and refinement. These ornate decorative objects were an extravagance intended to be purchased for display or personal use by a household member, rather than for the utilitarian practicality required of all furniture pieces during this period in the average American household. Although differing in design and finish, the typical 19th century writing desk featured a sloping writing surface that concealed tiers of drawers, plus compartments and pigeonholes for organizing letters and papers. The sloped surface of these desks often had hinges that allowed users to fold it back to reveal compartments hidden below. Davenport and Wooten are among the most famous desk designs from the 19th century. The Davenport desk shared the same basic shape as other English and American writing desks from that period, but the drawers on the pedestal base opened to the side rather than the front. Created by a British military officer, it featured a heavy, sturdy structure. The Wooten desk, which peaked in popularity during the Victorian era, was typically built from walnut and featured a high decorative and ornate design. This desk had a sloping writing surface that consisted of a pair of doors opening to the sides, revealing an unusually high number of compartments hidden within. Moving into the 20th century, desks evolved with the design movements of the time and the needs of a more literate and modern society. Steam-driven woodworking machines made cheap wood pulp paper possible for the mass manufacturing of desk forms, which provided office equipment for an expanding white-collar workforce, and the one-piece school desk designed and patented by Anna Breden in the late 1880s for the hundreds of new public schools opening across the country. The desk rose in importance in the 20th century as a useful and personal piece of furniture, both at home and in the office. Desk designs reflected the modern times' importance and functionality in spaces dedicated to the privacy and concentration required of the work performed on its surface, and later in the century, its proximity to a wall outlet. The needs and requirements of a desk in the home are more important than ever, as millions of Americans learned this past year when they were forced. Before COVID, the laptop and tablet reduced the need for dedicated workspace, particularly for urban apartment dwellers tight on living space. Wi-Fi and portable devices meant you could now work from your bed, living room, couch, at the kitchen table, down the block at a coffee shop, on the train. Our time at home during COVID underscored the importance, once again, of creating a dedicated space. There is no doubt the desks are back in style and the home office is making a comeback. So is an appreciation for the desks upon which history was written, that tell a story of their own, which you can learn more about in this month's issue of the Journal of Antiques and Collectibles.
The writing desks and habits of famous authors. It is said that Kurt Vonnegut used his hardwood floor as his desk. He worked from his lap with everything, papers, notes, drafts, spread out around him. Virginia Woolf often wrote in a low armchair with a plywood board across her knee. Henry David Thoreau wrote Walden on a simple Hepplewhite-style desk made of painted pine. Whether it's a table at a local coffee shop, where J.K. Rowling is said to have written Harry Potter, a writer shed far from the maddening crowds, an outfitted home office, barstool, or lone corner with an inspirational view, writers are as much inspired by their writing tables as they are the writing routines that keep them engaged until the last word gets on the page. Looking for some inspiration and creativity for your own writing project? Consider what's worked for these famous writers. In 1794, Jane Austen's father gave her a portable writing box. When open, it provided a slope on which to rest paper while writing. Its various compartments include a space for an inkpot and a lockable drawer for paper and valuables. Between 1795 and 1799, Austen produced first drafts of what would later become Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, and Northanger Abbey, perhaps using this very writing desk. While traveling through Dartford in 1798, she almost lost it, and her savings of £7, when it was accidentally placed in a horse-drawn chaise heading for Dover. When Austen died in 1817, aged 41, the desk was inherited by her sister Cassandra. It was later passed down through her eldest brother's family. In 1999, Joan Austen Leigh, Jane Austen's great-great-great-niece, generously entrusted it to the care of the British Library. Considered one of the greatest novelists of the Victorian era, Charles Dickens had a very specific routine to his daily schedule, treating writing much as any day job. After waking at 7 a.m., breakfast at 8, he was in his study working by 9 a.m., not leaving until 2 p.m. when he had lunch with his family. After that, he'd take a vigorous 3-hour walk. These walks were integral to Dickens' success as an author. Not only did they provide him with space to muse on his writing and consider future developments, they were also key to Dickens' unrivaled knowledge of the city. The rest of his evening was spent in relaxation and contemplation. With this rigid schedule, Dickens was able to keep up with his constant deadlines and could easily produce 2,000 words a day. Louisa May Alcott is well known for her classic novel Little Women. She wrote by hand at her writing desk at Orchard House. After years of disappointing reception to her writing, her publisher suggested that she try writing a girl's story. She composed the book that became Little Women in 2.5 months, basing it on her own life experiences with her sister. Neither she nor her publishers were impressed by the manuscripts, but it was published and quickly sold out the first edition. The book was an overnight success that still stands the test of time. Guests of Orchard House, the Alcott family home-turned-museum in Massachusetts, can find her simple shelf writing desk in the corner of her second-floor restored bedroom. Mark Twain, authors of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, rose early Monday through Saturday to eat a hearty breakfast, then immediately retreated to his study. He remained in there writing until about 5 p.m., working straight through the day and even skipping lunch. Twain's family was taught never to disturb him while he was writing, nor even come near his study so that he wouldn't be distracted. If they absolutely needed him, the family was instructed to blow a horn from another part of the house, which would get his attention. It was his habit to keep 4 or 5 books in process all the time and to continually add new chapters to 2 to 3 each year to keep the process along. Quote, "It takes 7 years to complete a book by this method, but it is still a good method. It gives the public a rest." Known for his role in revolutionizing comedic drama, English playwright George Bernard Shaw sought inspiration in the gardens of his Edwardian villa known as Shaw Corner, in a writing shed he had constructed on the property. While he had a traditional study, most of his writing happened in the shed, which was built on a turntable and designed to rotate so his writing desk, when faced the window looking across the lawns and gardens, always received the best light to work in. Shaw's writing hut also included an electric heater, typewriter, a bunk for Napoleonic naps, and a telephone to the house which could always be used for emergencies such as lunch. Surely everything a writer could need, says his biographer, Michael Holroyd. His writing shed not only allowed Shaw to work in and be inspired by nature, but to seek refuge from people. Shaw Corner and the writing desk have been preserved by the National Trust, much as he left it. Novelist and playwright James Baldwin is known for many works, including his essay collection, Notes of a Native Son. He had unique writing habits because he often had a day job. He would begin his writing work at night once his kids were in bed. Even when he became established enough in his writing career to ditch the day job, he continued writing at night when he could be alone. "When you're writing, you're trying to find out something which you don't know," said Baldwin in an 1984 interview with the Paris Review. "The whole language of writing for me is finding out what you don't want to know, what you don't want to find out, but something forces you to anyway." Before he retired in 2012 from writing, famed American novelist Philip Roth, author of Goodbye Columbus, Portnoy's Complaint, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning American Pastoral, exclusively used standing desks, with one in his Upper West Side work studio and another at his house in the woods of Connecticut. He keeps his desk near windows but at right angles to the view, presumably to avoid distraction. Roth claims he would pace for about half a mile for every page he writes. With Roth's astonishing body of work, that's a lot of walking. In a 1984 interview with Hermione Lee, Roth shares, "I would work all day, morning and afternoon, just about every day. If I sit there like that for 2 or 3 years, at the end, I have a book. Writing isn't hard work. It's a nightmare." While the process of writing is unique to each individual and never an easy task, the right desk, desk chair, and quiet space with a view can hopefully spark the inspiration you need to express yourself and make history with your words. And we're back with That's a Lot, sharing the latest gavel down prices on some of the most interesting items coming to market. A 1911 photograph of Shoeless Joe Jackson, signed by the baseball star himself, sold for $1.47 million at auction this past October. It's the most anyone has ever paid for a signed sports photograph, per the Associated Press and ESPN, and it is the only known Jackson-signed photograph of himself in existence. Jackson was banned from baseball for life in 1921, even though he was acquitted in the 1919 Black Sox game-fixing scandal. A first American edition copy of Herman Melville's Moby Dick, or The Whale, sold for $60,000 at a fine books and manuscript sale held August 28th by Potter & Potter Auctions in Chicago. The book is the Sailor Ishmael's narrative of the obsessive quest of Ahab, captain of the whaling ship Pequod, for revenge on Moby Dick, the giant white sperm whale that on the ship's previous voyage bit off Ahab's leg at the knee. Melville began writing Moby Dick in February 1850 and finished 18 months later, a year longer than he had anticipated. Melville drew on his experience as a common sailor from 1841 to 1844, including several years on whalers and on wide reading in whale literature. The book's ending is based on the sinking of the whale ship Essex in 1820. A 1957 real estate contract signed by Elvis Presley and both of his parents for the purchase of the home in Memphis known as Graceland sold for $114,660 at an online auction held by pristineauction.com. The contract was the actual purchase agreement allowing the Presleys to purchase the property at 3764 Highway 51 in Memphis. Virginia Grant's handwritten agreement stated the Presleys would trade their property on Audubon Drive in Memphis for $55,000 credit, plus an additional $90,000 to purchase Graceland. Graceland was Elvis's world. He and his parents lived and died there. An illustrated Hebrew prayer book dating to the late 13th, early 14th century in southern Germany sold for $8.3 million, well above the pre-sale estimate of $4 to $6 million at Sotheby's in October, and established a new auction record for a Hebrew manuscript. The work was acquired by a renowned American collector who has one of the most significant collections of medieval Hebrew manuscripts in the world, a scribal masterpiece that attests to the vibrancy of the medieval Jewish community in Europe. The Luzzatto High Holiday Mazor is the second most valuable object of Judaica ever to sell at auction, comparable only to the Bamberg Talmud from the Waldmadonna Library, which sold for $9.3 million, a world auction record for any object of Judaica. As a remarkable living document, the prayer book presents an incomparable chronicle of Jewish communities and their migration throughout medieval Europe, with less than 20 surviving examples from this period and geography believed to exist today. A copy of Amazing Fantasy No. 15 from 1962, featuring the first comic book appearance of Spider-Man by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, sold for $3.6 million at a comic and comic art signature auction held September 8th through 12th by Heritage Auctions in Dallas. It was the most ever paid for a comic book, eclipsing the $3.25 million paid earlier this year for a copy of Action Comics No. 1. This is one of the best-known origin stories in the entire comic book medium, featuring Peter Parker gaining his spider powers and the death of his beloved Uncle Ben. To view the entire November issue with additional articles on inkwells, the Parker Pen Archives, the history of the Larkin Desk, and more, visit journalofantiques.com, where you will also find other past articles of interest, a calendar of upcoming shows and auctions, antique shops to visit around the country, and other news and resources to keep you active and engaged. While there, you can also subscribe to receive our publication in print and sign up to receive our bi-monthly free e-newsletter, Post-Press Updates. The Journal of Antiques and Collectibles is published by Weathervane Enterprises, Inc. Thank you for listening to All Things Collected. Join us next month when we explore the outfitting of the 19th century gentleman.